to order. And for the record, I'm one of the co-chairs, Senator McGuire. Senator Wilikowski is the other co-chair. And in the interest of fairness, we're just rotating every other hearing for now. So it's a social experiment. You'll all stand by and see if it works. We're hoping it does. Present for the record are Senator Huggins, Stevens, French, of course, Wilikowski, and myself, McGuire. We do have an excused absence from Senator Wagner, and we are awaiting Senator Stedman. We have one overview today. That's the issue of natural gas for in-state use, and we have three folks, the representatives of three individual groups here today to give us an update. It's not meant to be comprehensive, as I've explained to them, but rather just an initial overview. We have the Alaska Gas Line Port Authority, and we have Bill Walker here from that organization. We have the Alaska Natural Gas Development Authority and Harold Hines. And finally, we have Colleen Starring with NSTAR. And it was asked to me, you know, what our intention was, and Senator Wilikowski and I thought that it would be symbolic to start out with this issue since we feel it's the most important pressing issue that we'll face as resource co-chairman in the next 2 years, trying to get in-state gas to the people of our state. So without further ado, Bill Walker, if you'd go ahead and lead out. You each have 30 minutes.
Very good. Thank you very much, Madam Chair, for this opportunity to come before the Senate Resources Committee. It seems like this is sort of where we ended up at the last special session, so it feels good to sort of be back again and with sort of a little bit different approach than where we ended it. So I appreciate this opportunity. Before I get into the presentation, which will be brief, you've been through our financial analysis, which sometimes have taken a couple of days, so this will be nothing like that. This is just to be a brief overview of what we've done and why we've done what we've done and why we're still doing what we're doing. So before I do that, I want to just mention and introduce our board members, sort of unsung heroes of the Port Authority. Some have been at it for 10 years. It's a volunteer board, 9 members, currently chaired by Bert Cottle, the mayor of the city of Valdez. Vice chair is Dave Cobb, also city council member of Valdez. The secretary is Luke Hopkins of the Fairbanks North Star Borough. The treasurer is Merrick Pierce, independent businessman in Fairbanks. And we also have on our board Mayor Jim Whitaker, mayor of the Fairbanks North Star Borough. We have Harold Curran, the chief operating officer of the North Slope Borough. Randy Hoffbeck, who is the chief financial officer for the North Slope Borough. And Rex Rock from Point Hope, who is the chairman of the board of the ASRC, Arctic Slope Regional Corporation. So we have 9 members, and I'm fortunate to have them. They'll come together on a 24-hour notice of a meeting, sometime driving all night from one city to another to be there in person. So it's an honor to be representing them today.
Thank you very much. And just for the record, we've been joined by Senator Stedman. And I also wanted to mention that we have Senator Pasquin and Senator Thomas, who is an honorary member of the Senate Resources Committee for 3 years now, and Representative Ramirez, who's in the room.
It's always a pleasure to start off with a thank you, and I start off with a thank you to the entire legislature for what you did for us last year. At the morning following the passage of AGEA, the legislature put together legislative intent language, passed by 58-1, pretty overwhelming majority, which is very, very helpful to us. What that allowed us to do is to go out to our partners and to the market to show that the Alaska legislature do not be concerned with the, you know, some said, well, exclusive license to TransCanada, it looks like LNG is over. What you did when the passage of the legislative intent proved that was not the case, that the legislature has every bit of interest in the LNG project being considered and evaluated. So thank you very much for that. That was very helpful. Following that, we received Administrative Order 242 from Governor Palin, and her administration worked hard on putting that together. That also, coupled with the legislative intent language, was very, very helpful. It allowed us to keep partners in the game, keep companies that in the private sector that were investing money in this effort continue to do that. So those two acts of one by the legislature, one by the administration, and Governor Palin were extremely helpful, and we thank you very much for that. We sort of labored as far as how to thank you for it, and every time we came up with it, there was always another reason why not to do it. So you'll be hearing that a bit more, because it's a pleasure to be able to start off with a thank you, because that was just extremely helpful. If you had not done that, we probably would not be here today. One of the more enjoyable trips I was asked to take for the board was a trip to Hawaii to meet with an organization called the Office of Hawaiian Affairs. They are a somewhat of an equivalent to the Alaska Federation of Natives. They're the native organizations in Hawaii that are looking at bringing in LNG into their state for use. Currently, Hawaii is energized largely by coal and diesel, and they're looking at cleaner burning fuel and perhaps decoupling from the higher costs of diesel. So they have expressed a strong interest in LNG out of Alaska. And as part of that, we worked with the it's called OHA, Organization of Hawaiian Affairs, for a resolution by the AFN at the last convention. And so the AFN passed a resolution 0842, and I have copies of all these if you'd like copies. It's supporting an LNG project that assists energy to rural Alaska as well as to Hawaii. So you'll be hearing more about the Office of Hawaiian Affairs. I think there's been an interest of perhaps coming to Juneau to speak with you. So we're pleased with that relationship, and it's an opportunity that we anticipate continue to develop. We've continued with working with Mitsubishi and Sempra. I think that was that's been a long-term relationship, and it's one that continues on. We're just now entering into our next level of agreement with those companies, and they have asked me to express to you their interest to come to Juneau and speak to you directly. So at your convenience, if that could be scheduled at some point, I think they would have an interesting appreciate the message that they would bring on what is happening somewhat on the world market and explain why they're interested in involved in this project, in the Alaska LNG project. Mitsubishi, of course, really needs no introduction, but I always mention that they bring in approximately 50% of the LNG into the Asian market, a very, very significant player in that market. We're fortunate to have both Sempra and Mitsubishi. Sempra, of course, is one of the largest marketers of natural gas in the lower 48. So we feel we sort of market, we cover both spectrums, both the world market as well as the U.S. market by having both of those entities. Our focus since the passage of AGEA has been getting ready for the open season, which is targeted for July of 2010. Towards that end, we have met with TransCanada a number of times, and as you recall, TransCanada has committed to build a standalone line to Valdez, independent of a Canadian line, if there's sufficient customers for shipment on that line. And that, we think, you were involved in that process as well, and we thank you for that. We think that's a significant piece, partly because we think TransCanada is a very good pipeline company. We have spent many days in Calgary with them long before AGEA submitted and began. And we're very pleased with their track record, and so we're happy to be working with them as a pipeline company. So our plan is to continue to work with them to prepare for the open season, and towards that end, it's just nice to have that piece taken care of. Is somebody else taking care of the pipeline piece? Our piece is the liquefaction fractionation facility in Valdez. What we will be working on is the cost estimates for the liquefaction fractionation facility in Valdez. What we have to do is we need to basically have the same level of cost estimate that TransCanada has. They have proposed a Class 4 cost estimate. We need to make sure that our cost estimate for the pipeline to Valdez, we need to make sure that our cost estimate for the liquefaction and the fractionation units are of comparable class, so that it flanges up for a, because no one will be wanting to ship just to the end of the pipe. They'll need to know all the way through, including the shipping piece of it. So what we will cover will be the liquefaction and the shipping. Some will take care of their own shipping, some will not, but we'll take care of that part of it. And you know, as we've, you know, our goal, obviously, is to attract customers to the open season. And so, obviously, we want to make it as attractive as possible to the shippers, those that own the gas, whether they're going to be producers at the North Slope currently or someone will be buying it at the North Slope from the producers. Our goal is to make it as attractive of an option to market that commodity as possible. So that's largely where our focus is going to be. We've said before, and we haven't changed our story, that we believe that LNG maximizes the wellhead value of the gas. And we'll get into a few later slides, and we'll show how we support that. But in saying that, you know, we are all about in-state use of gas. Our GEA application initially had 22 offtake points, and we narrowed it down to 18. That's the kind of focus we have on in-state gas. We contacted every military base in the state, or members of our board did. Any industrial user. So our goal is to get as much gas utilized in Alaska as possible. Towards that end, we have had a long-standing relationship with ANGDA. We've had an MOU signed with them about in-state use of gas. We've followed what they have done. Recently, on a Saturday morning, about 2 weeks ago, Scott Hayworth attended one of our board meetings, and we attended their meeting the following Wednesday. So that's going to be something I think we're going to be doing on a regular basis, working closer with ANGDA. We applaud what they're doing. We applaud that the, I think, boots in the field is the term that Harold has used. We're glad that they're doing that. We think that brings value to getting gas to Alaskans. We hope that their line only has to go to Glen Allen instead of all the way to Delta. That's what we're working towards. And so, anyway, we applaud what they're doing, and we will continue to work with them. The market change is really the biggest change that's happened since in the past 12 months really is what's happened in the market. The shale gas development is pretty astounding, what has happened in shale gas. I have provided a couple of articles at the appended to our presentation. There's about perhaps 100 that I could have appended that basically say the same thing. The shale gas, and I don't go into big, you know, discussion on how it works, but basically they go in and horizontal drilling, they fracture the gas with hydraulically with water, and the gas comes out. The estimates are absolutely huge. The Marcella play, which was in the West Virginia to New York, initially was estimated at 500 trillion cubic feet. About 10 days ago, that estimate was increased to 1,300 trillion cubic feet. There's estimates of 2,000 to 3,000 trillion cubic feet of gas available in the shale gas development. What caused this to happen and develop so quickly is when the price went to $13 at Henry Hub, suddenly there was plenty of money for technology to go in and do things that they couldn't do at $2 and $3. And some of the articles that I've read, they refer to technology as the absolute unsung hero in this process, because that's really what has caused it to happen. Now with the prices has dropped down, the question is how will that affect the shale gas? Recent articles, as recently as a week ago, have said at $5 is still a money-making, they can still make money at $5 on the shale gas. Today's price at Henry Hub is $4.79. So it's right in the $4.80 to $5 range, significantly different than $13. But what this has done is it's brought down the price. The increase of gas in the last 12 months, the increase of gas production in the U.S. is up 10%, 15% in Texas alone, and that's because of the shale gas. It's just a tremendous sea change, a game changer is what they said in Canada, as far as what's happened on the shale gas. I believe it was day before yesterday, Ottawa has made the decision to put a couple billion dollars into the McKinsey project. One of the justifications, concerns raised was, you know, we need to get ahead of the shale gas because that's going to definitely impact the price of gas in North America. So we think that's significant, and we believe that that's going to we're glad that Alaska has multiple options. We think that LNG makes an abundance of sense, and certainly now with what's happened in the shale gas and what's happened in the lower 48 or in North America. One of the largest shale gas plays is believed to be in the Horn River Valley, which is in the British Columbia, northeast portion of British Columbia. Some have speculated recently, as a week ago, that that could be as big as the Barnett shale gas play in Texas. So I had to sort of see the irony of the municipal ordinance in Fort Worth that says that you can drill a gas well, within 600 feet of someone's home and be without a variance, but a variance you can go within 200 feet of their home, and the way you get the variance is everybody shares in the royalty. So there's a tremendous amount of interest in the shale gas. They're currently producing out of the Fort Worth area about 3 BCF of gas, and they believe it can go to 6 BCF. So all that said is that it just significantly, we believe, change the dynamics of North America on gas. So when you're getting to 2 to 3,000 trillion cubic feet, you're talking some serious gas, and the plays are sort of spread out across the continent. So it's great news for North America. It's great news for security of supply. Some have speculated that there's enough for the next 100 years in the shale gas development. So that's very, very significant. As we've watched that, we've also watched the competition, our competition, sort of take advantage of that. 13 months ago, we received a letter from a Kitimat receiving terminal as part of our AGEA process, a letter of intent saying we'd like to have LNG come from Alaska into Kitimat. And we appreciated that. And about a week ago, they had an announcement, which was not a surprise to us, but an announcement that they are now an LNG export terminal. And their new partner in it is Mitsubishi Corporation, the same as we have. And we certainly don't fault them or in any way. It just is another indication to us that people are putting a lot of credence in the shale gas development. So that's they're looking at the Asian market. They're looking at the premium Asian market, as they put it, as far as where their LNG would be going to. So they acknowledge in their media releases the change of pricing in the lower 48, and therefore it makes more sense for them to be exporting into the Asian market. So that gives us some competition. That's the first real competition we've had on the West Coast at all. And so it sort of builds a fire upon us to make sure that we continue to do what we're doing a little faster, a little harder, to make sure that we get that opportunity. So as we look at the in-state gas pipeline project, and we're sort of a little bit in between both. We're certainly an in-state project, but we're an export project as well. The same as TransCanada is an in-state until they get the Canadian border, then they're an export project into the Alberta trading hub at AECO. So we're sort of in between, but I particularly appreciate being here today as part of the in-state, because that's really the sort of the heart of what we're about. And if you look at what we refer to as the All Alaska Line, the LNG project, it's as far as reserves, an important piece of it, we come from the North Slope, where they inject 8.4 billion cubic feet of gas every day, of which 2.7 could be taken off today, according to the AOGCC Rule 9 regulation. So we come from an existing source of approved reserves on gas, is where our project would begin. We believe that the LNG provides the highest netback to the to the North Slope producers and to the state. We think that's important. If you're a holder of a lease and want to get the highest net back, we think that that's important that we can provide that. We think it's an important, it's helpful that for a later line through Canada, that they could tie in at Delta Junction, and there'd be 550 miles of shared line. We think that the economics, that helps the economics if that, if and when that moves forward. We're not interested in waiting for that to happen before a line through the rest of Alaska takes place. So that's why we're pleased with the independent standalone line to Valdez if there are sufficient customers. We do not have a volume restriction of 500 MCF. We are within AGEA. We would be utilizing your licensed entity, TransCanada. Our volume will be what the market will bear. If it's 2.7 or 3, it depends upon the train sizes and depends upon the consumption within Alaska. We think that's a positive thing to not be limited but to the 500 MCF. There are some parts of Alaska that have never had access to natural gas. It's hard to sort of put a plug number out there and say, we think this is about all we're going to use. We may see some natural resource development that's limited only by our imagination in this state, and we like the idea of being able to exceed the 500 to whatever the capacity in the state would be.
Madam Chair.
Yes. Senator Huggins.
One quick question. Does TransCanada agree with no restriction on 500 MCF?
They have. Yes, TransCanada has said if, as long as it comes through their line, they don't care if it's 6 BCF or 10 or 1, as long as it's coming through their line. And that's what we have committed to at this point, to work with them.
Do you have that in writing somewhere? Or?
We're in the process of obtaining that.
Okay. That would be helpful if you could forward any written documents that you have solidifying that agreement.
We certainly will. We'd be happy to, Madam Chair. So TransCanada is already working on the open season. They've done the overflight to Valdez, which they've explained to me took them about a month of waiting for the clouds to clear so that they could do that. But they're in the process of doing that. We are working on our volume estimate to provide to them. We expect to do that yet this week as far as the volume that we for their cost estimate. They need to know the size of the pipe, the kind of pressure, so they can come up with their cost estimate for the Valdez portion. So we're meeting with them with Mitsubishi and Sempra and engaging with them on working toward their open season. The pipeline route, sometimes I refer to it as the most studied piece of earth on the earth, parallel to TAPS. It's received 3 EISs. 2 environmental impact statements have been done by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, 1 by Yukon Pacific Corporation. Mm-hmm. There are really few surprises in that route at this point. So that we think that's helpful. Of course, from the pipeline side, that's going to be TransCanada. That's going to be doing the pipeline portion of that. We would enjoy all the benefits of AGEA, expedited considerations. I mean, certainly was mentioned in your intent language and the governor's order 242, but it's also in AGEA in the legislation that if you're working within AGEA, you receive the benefits of that. So we're pleased about that. When we say benefits of that, we mean just the expedited review. We're happy to be part of that. We strongly believe that the largest in-state line you have is sort of creates the anchor for more economical gas throughout Alaska. I think that, and ours is to have a line obviously all the way to Valdez, and the offtake locations, however many they may be, will benefit from that larger volume. And our anchor tenant is the world market. The meetings that I have had the pleasure of attending in Tokyo with Tokyo Gas and Tokyo Electric and other companies, they're very interested in gas from Alaska since they've been receiving gas from LNG from Alaska since October of 1969 from Nikiski. So Alaska has, I think, the highest rating in the world on-time deliveries, and it is by far the longest contract that's ever been honored. And that means a lot to companies that must have that to generate their product of electricity and natural gas. So we have the anchor tenant, and the anchor tenants are there and anxious to, and how that would be distributed throughout on the world market between the west coast of the U.S., Hawaii, and the Asian market. The market will really be the test for that. We like the fact that it's all within Alaska. I mean, obviously, all the in-state projects are all within Alaska. Obviously, that's the intent of today's hearings.
Senator Wilkowski?
We think we're in control of that.
Thank you. Next year, when we have the open season in May or June, the Asian corporations or Asian countries will have an opportunity to bid on the gas, or rather make deals with the oil companies to put the gas in the line for a line down to Valdez. Is that correct?
That's correct. Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, they would either be able to buy it at the wellhead prior to the open season, or purchase it with the shipper, the current lessee, retaining control of it to their site.
Do you have any sense, based on information that you can share, whether or not there are states or countries or organizations that are planning on doing that?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, what I can say about that is we would probably not have the participants with us that we have if that wasn't the case. If Mitsubishi did not believe that was the case, if Sempra did not, I don't think they would be with us in this process. So I think they have a high level of confidence that will happen, that it would be at a successful open season.
Thank you.
Further questions from the committee this time? Okay, thank you very much.
Yep.
We'll have you back again. Oh, Senator Wilkowski.
Didn't realize he was done with his presentation. I've got a couple questions. So I think the most important thing for Alaskans is the quickest and cheapest natural gas that they can get, whether it's Fairbanks or the Bush or South Central, Southeast. In your opinion, is your route the best, quickest, cheapest way to go? Or if not, I mean, what is the best for Alaskans, in your opinion, in terms of the cheapest, quickest way to get gas?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, we think we are the quickest because just the sheer economics of it, because it's coming down a permitted route. There are approved reserves. There is a market that will take the excess volume that Alaska cannot use. So we think that we believe that the line parallel to TAPS through to an existing corridor is the quickest and the surest. And really, we think the goal is not just to get gas to Alaskans, but to get gas to Alaskans at an economical price. And that's really what the LNG project provides. It provides the anchor tenant that allows there to be economies of scale for the transportation of that gas. The goal is to get the tariff as low as possible. I think that we'll recall that from testimony from TransCanada that same kind of benefit that I'm talking about as far as the lower tariff because of the volume equated to approximately $10 billion through the life of the line through Canada to the consumers of Canada, and that's fine. We're saying that same concept would apply in Alaska. So we think this would be the size of it and the economics would be the best option for the in-state for Alaska.
And if I could, Madam Chair, two follow-ups. What do you project, or do you have a projection on what the tariff costs would be to, say, Fairbanks and, say, Anchorage?
Well, that Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, that really depends upon the volume that shows up at the open season. Obviously, it has to be sufficient volume that is going to be able to offset the cost of the project. But the volume will be the tariff will certainly be significantly lower than a much smaller line that does not have the benefit of sort of the largesse of a 48-inch line, let's say.
One other follow-up. Are you concerned at all about the recent rejection of the renewal of the permits for Yukon Pacific?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, I'm not. I know that company has spent a lot of time and money in putting together their efforts. I believe they are asking for reconsideration, and that my understanding is that may be granted to them. So I don't know that affects what we're doing one way or the other. We'll either work with them to work with them with their permits, or we'll apply for our own permit. So I don't think that's a problem for us at all.
Thank you.
Senator French.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question about the export license. The one of the hang-ups with the LNG project has long been, or at least I've always viewed it as being questionable, is whether you could get an export license to take our product to Japan overseas. And given the sort of the tight restrictions on that ability, the whole project seems to stumble. But now I'm sitting here wondering whether the recent discoveries of large volumes of natural gas in the lower 48, while they seem to be an impediment to our big line to the Midwest, may not provide an opportunity for us to revisit the political difficulty of shipping our gas overseas, and whether you or anybody else have begun to explore whether the Obama administration would maybe look more favorably on an export license of Alaska's gas, given these large new discoveries.
Senator French, to the chair, we have followed that closely, and thank you for that question. I was actually going to end with that. We have followed that closely, and we believe that the law is clear, is that there's a presumption of export. You know, America wants to export products, and you have to in order to not grant it, it has to be overcome that preponderance of proof that there will not be enough gas in the U.S. if that is exported. Well, we think what has happened on the shale gas has absolutely answered that question with a resounding yes. There is plenty of gas in the U.S. There is also a possibility of doing it, the export license, in such a way that it could be interruptible contracts, such that in the event that there ever was a shortage of gas in Lower 48, that could be diverted to locations on the receiving terminals in the U.S. So we think that balance of payments is an important issue now with the economy. We think that we would be happy with any one of the reports that have come out. ICF has come out with some significant reports in Washington, D.C. on the amount of shale gas. When the energy consultants are referring to the Lower 48 as a wash in gas, and references to 100 years of gas availability in the Lower 48, that's good news for us from the standpoint as Alaskans, that when we go for that export license, that will be the evidence that we will be submitting to support the ability to export. You know, one thing that has been brought to our attention is that, a gas to Americans, we're Americans too. And if Alaskans have to export in order to be able to use it ourselves, that should be taken into consideration as well. And we shouldn't be prevented from using our resource because of fear of some point in the future there could be a shortage in the Lower 48. So thank you for that question.
Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and I thank Senator French for asking that question, because that was the first part of my question. The second part is, in the other 800-pound gorilla, is there's two countries that buy our bonds, Japan and China, and economic interdependence and us having this sort of relationship and supply to them and their great thirst for it, particularly Chinese, may become overwhelmingly important for us as we build up this growing debt of trillions, which probably is even more important than the export permit, because it may be fundamentally spring-loaded till we have to do the export permit when we look at the economic analysis of who buys our bonds.
And just in wrap-up, do you care to comment on NSTAR is going to make a presentation here today as well. Do you see it as a competing proposal? Are they mutually exclusive for your project to go forward in conjunction with TransCanada? Is it mutually exclusive of a bullet line by a company such as NSTAR? Yeah.
Madam Chair, we're pleased with anybody that's looking at moving gas in Alaska. And so we don't really look at it as a competitor. We look at it as a different concept. They have a totally different concept that we have. Our hope and goal is to make sure that the one that's best for Alaska, proceeds. We are working with TransCanada because of the AGEA process, and because of the volumes restrictions associated, and because the opportunity to have the anchor tenant be in the world market. So we certainly don't see what NSAR is doing. We applaud that there are anybody that's expending time, money, and effort to get gas throughout Alaska. We applaud that effort.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your time. Okay, and next, we're falling a little bit behind, my apologies, by 10 minutes. We have Harold Hines and Engda. And we'll take a brief at ease to allow you guys to shift. Back in order, it's 4:10, and we left off bringing Harold Hines up to talk to us about Engda's proposal.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's a pleasure to be before you. I was here about 6 months ago, last time I recollect, and as you'll notice, I even just sort of titled my presentation Engda Since July. I do not intend to go back through lots of things.
Good.
This is going to be an update of where we were and where what we've been doing in the last 6 months and what we see probably during this session over the next 6 months, maybe as the two or three really key things that have to be addressed on the in-state gas issue. I need to start, though, by defining what's different today than it was when we were here in July. Of course, in July, oil prices were at sort of an excessively high level of number. And as we sit here today, we've experienced an excessively fast decline in those prices. We've certainly experienced, to a large degree, a major meltdown of financing. We sit at the front edge of potentially very significant employment and economic issues facing the country and facing the state. And that all those three factors are entirely different than where we were. Now, that's not all bad. There's some bad in there, but there's also some good. One of the things that has happened since then is we have created some momentum on the big gas pipeline. Again, in July, we were sitting here kind of waiting. Is the big pipe going to happen? Is something going to move forward? As we sit here today, you have two very active sponsor groups who you're going to hear from Monday, moving forward, a lot of effort, and there's a lot of momentum that's generated out of that, and we see that as positive. The second thing is, frankly, the decline in oil prices bought us some time. It gave us some relief. Folks all over Alaska, whether it was in August or September or whatever, we're really, really, really having trouble. And we still have people in rural and bush Alaska still reeling because they had to buy fuel back then. And they're still suffering that high price. But we do now at least exist in a world today where we've gotten a little bit of time on the curve. And that's good. Let me give you a feel for what Engda has worked on during that period of time, recognizing those dynamics were all occurring while we were doing this. Number one, I've given you a larger scale map, but I want to define for you the project that we're working on right now. And it has embedded in it a number of other projects, other ideas that have been before you before, but we refer to this as the Beluga to Fairbanks project. And it provides basically for a linkage from the Beluga area on the north side of Cook Inlet up to the Palmer area. It then links Palmer through Glen Allen to Delta Junction in a high-pressure gas pipeline, and then it provides for either a high-density plastic pipe linking Delta Junction on up into the Fairbanks area, or in a small-diameter steel pipe on, again, a more temporary basis, awaiting the arrival of the big pipe. That project is an outgrowth of basically a challenge that was put to us because of the extreme situation that Fairbanks was in terms of a lack of alternatives for energy and the high costs they were experiencing, probably about three times what we were experiencing in Cook Inlet at that time. That is the B2F project. Parts of that you've heard me describe before. You know we have a conditional right-of-way between the Palmer-Glen Allen area from the state of Alaska. We parallel basically the Trans-Alaska pipeline very closely all the way from Glen Allen up to Delta Junction and then even on up to Fairbanks. To give you a feel for how we have progressed this project, let me just start off with the first few things on my list. Number one, we've defined that project. And we had to create it from whole cloth. We sewed in some of the ingredients that we had been working on and some of the things, frankly, we've been working on for a few years. And we finally stitched it together. We actually can make sense out of this project economically, feeding a relatively small volume of Cook Inlet gas all the way up to Fairbanks. Now, I'm not going to say the economics are the greatest, but if it had existed in July, the people in Fairbanks would have yelled hallelujah, because it would have provided very significant relief to them in terms of the cost of gas. Now, as they sit there today, I'm not sure they would really be very interested in this project at $35 oil or $40 oil. But that's the reality of it. They're probably not interested in a lot of other ideas at $40 oil, because that's probably the world they've been in for many, many years. I don't think any of us hold an expectation that we will remain at $40 for a long and extended period of time. It's reasonable to suspect that some point in the future we will either go up or we will even peak up from where we are at. So we see this project as one that is worthy of moving forward and at least have it as an option. And again, I would describe to you ANGDA's work as trying to preserve options. None of these require huge commitments at this point. We can advance them, and we have advanced them with very modest efforts and expenditures compared to the scale of the potential savings and the potential rewards for Alaskans. We finished the wetlands work along that entire route this last summer. Even though it got defined during the summer while we had already started our wetlands work, we did go ahead and we extended both ends of that work, and we actually have in the final stages before the Corps of Engineers that wetlands field work. That's a major permitting step required before you can do almost any project in Alaska. We also have initiated at this point the in federal environmental impact statement on, again, the entire Beluga to Fairbanks project. That represents the necessary step for the federal right-of-way usage, for the state right-of-way usage, all the other federal permits that may be involved, in particular, again, the Corps of Engineers permit. That process will take about 18 months in total. Having initiated at this point in time, we should, in less than a year from now, have a draft result, which will tell us if there are any real issues, and we don't expect there to be any very difficult issues, but it will tell us if there are. More importantly, in about 18 months, we should have our final permits out of the process on it. The Corps of Engineers is the lead agency. We hired a contractor, URS, to work under the Corps' supervision. There's a public process involved and a number of other steps in moving this forward. It is significant in that we have started and we are moving along and the clock is running. There is no way to do an EIS in less than about 18 months because of all the steps and all the sequence involved. So we're making very good progress. Embedded in that B2F is lots of pieces of the puzzle that we think are important, and it is our expectation that we will have our permissions in very good order by the end of the year, certainly by the end of the first half of 2010, and be in a position, if that was the choice, to start building something. I've also indicated there below that we did use part of the support we've received to help form the core of a value-added manufacturing conference in April of this year. It's jointly sponsored with the Triborough mayors in the Cook Inlet area. It is a world-class conference designed to attract the major international petrochemical companies and light up Alaska and the availability of a huge quantity of ethane that may be coming off the North Slope for their potential consideration. It's a first step, but it's a crucial first step. It was the best way we could see, frankly, to advance this. We have a number of people working on it that ANGDA hired through the Anchorage Economic Development Council to actually put on the conference. I then, on the right side of the list, have highlighted a few other things. We have open mutual interest discussions with TransCanada. Bill Walker of the Port Authority described to you the situation with TransCanada and their willingness under the AGEA and the resolution to look at going to Valdez. I will tell you that from my knowledge, TransCanada has been true to its word on that. It did place as much priority understanding Delta Junction to Valdez as it did Delta Junction to the border. Because we were already working and already interested in acquiring additional information in the Delta Junction to Glen Allen area, in that area of overlap, I think we'll find very productive in terms of working with them. They, of course, under the AGEA process, are spending a percentage, at least, of what they spend is public money. And it makes sense for us to work as closely with them as we can. We found the relationship to be a positive one at this point. A couple of other items that may come as a surprise to some of you. We've kind of signaled them in the past, but maybe a certain amount of the energy dilemma we found ourselves in caused us to accelerate them. One, we are seriously negotiating the purchase of propane molecules on the North Slope with the intent that when that agreement is reached, it would become the basis for the private sector construction of propane extraction plants, trucking, barging, all the activities associated with distributing propane from the North Slope. We believe that that will offer not only a fuel alternative to many communities along the rivers, along the roads, in the more rural areas of Alaska, it may actually offer opportunities for barges to come into a number of places reached by tidewater, including Cook Inlet, if necessary. And the terms of that agreement have not been finalized, but we have every reason to expect that the carry-through of those terms as a gas purchase, but of propane molecules, along with other accommodations for trucking and other things, will offer a competitive fuel price for many different parts of Alaska. We also announced last week our intention to form a gas supply co-op for the utilities. As you know, one of ANGDA's major concerns has been the role that we could play of aggregator. The idea that many of our utilities are fractured in their needs and they don't have the financial ability to take long-term positions, which is necessary to procure gas in the ground, to make shipping commitments, other things like that. So what we've done is we've looked at the alternatives, and frankly what we found is that the existing state statutes related to the formation of a co-op, corporation, a co-op, are very good in this case. It takes a very limited amount of people to prepare the papers of incorporation. What's visualized here is a traditional Kansas farmer type co-op, menu driven. You want to buy your gas from the co-op for the pickup truck, you can. You want to use the grain silos, you can. The members of the co-op set the menu. They drive the priorities of that menu. The members can choose to use pieces of that menu as they wish. In this case, the focus is on 7 or 8 of the electrical co-ops. I believe we have reasonable interest and support to at least take it to the step of forming this and seeing what types of items may be of interest. At the board meeting, we received some feedback that items like gas storage through this, items involving other things in terms of even immediate contracting for gas were of interest to the members in this aggregated and cooperative format.
What was the, Harold, if I can ask, what was the impetus for this? Is there a model out there that you'd come in contact with?
Madam Chair, there was about a year and a half ago, and for about 6 months, we conducted what we called open season workshops. And in the course of that, we were exposed to one person we brought up from the southeast part of the United States. There is a co-op of utilities there that buys gas in the ground. They basically buy producing fields in the United States. And their members are about 200 different utilities.
What is their name?
It's Georgia Gas Co-op, I believe, is the name. I'd be happy to get you all the information. I didn't bring it with. They are a co-op of utilities from about 6 different states. I forget the actual service number of people served by those electric utilities, but it includes Florida, so it's a very big number of millions, for sure, of customers. And it is part of their gas portfolio. What we're suggesting here is that since the electric utilities in Alaska number one, tend to be small and fractured. There's a aggregating, there's a coming together, there's a volume discount that comes out of this. But also, it allows them to lay off and work against and each other in terms of when they need things, I'll help you out this time, you help me out this time, time trades, all kinds of possibilities come out of this kind of a setup. It would be member-driven. ANGDA's job in this case is to facilitate, to help launch. We would probably be available on a continuing basis through bonding to help them if that was appropriate in terms of long-term purchase of either pipeline space or purchase of gas in the ground or other arrangements. A new idea in many ways, but I think it'll be moving forward. Should have more details for you, frankly, within a matter of a couple weeks. Our board meets tomorrow. They will be taking it under more serious consideration with discussion with the electric utilities. The electric utilities did appear at our board meeting last week and actually interacted with our board and discussed all this. And then finally, one of the things we've been working on since July is just exploring the whole concept of the potential private sector partner for a public-private partnership. It's our belief that the in-state system will benefit from not being either purely a public system or a private system, but will benefit from combining the public and private roles in a public-private partnership. And that's a classic approach used for many different things all over the United States. Our setting is a little different, and one of our issues has been, what are the real characteristics of the people that should be involved in this? What are the realistic goals? What are the realistic structures that go with it? And we have been working on that also. Let me jump then to the three things that I think represent major issues of emphasis for ANGDA and things that we believe you will see us progress in the next 6 months. One is we have placed at the top of the priority list, the ANGDA board has placed at the top of the priority list our work with the utilities to prepare for a fully and very active open season process with either TransCanada or Denali in 2010. And again, you can check with them Monday, but I believe both those pipeline sponsor groups have indicated clearly their intention to move to the open season step and process in 2010. Now, exactly whether that's January or June or November, I don't know at this point, and they may not. And even if they told you, I would suggest to you that in the sense of competitors, they probably will do it sooner than they would admit to right now, because there is an advantage to moving to that step in the process as far as being able to seek your FERC certification. So ANGDA's approach is to work with the utilities, make sure we've done everything we can to prepare them to participate, and again, maybe even through the co-op, in that open season process, and to do it, basically complete those preparations by the end of this year, 2009, so that we're in shape to do it. That's a lot of work that I just said. We've done a lot of work to get here. It's taken a lot of time and energy, a lot of good consultants, and some good contracts. It's going to take a lot more work to get there. But this is the single most important thing we see. We believe there is a tremendous advantage to the Alaskan consumer in terms of in-state gas being on the table from day one in the big pipelines open season. We feel that if we miss that opportunity to fully participate, there are severe penalties that may accrue to us. And that's not something we want to let happen because we didn't try. So again, that's why ANGDA has placed this at the top of the list of things to get done. In a similar way, I've got to describe to you what's frankly at the bottom of the list. And that is summer of 2010 field construction. As I've indicated to you, our permissions have moved along well. We're on a very aggressive time schedule on them. We believe there still exists today the opportunity for some significant level of field construction activities as early as 2010, the summer of 2010. That is, in our mind, though, a fleeting opportunity. It is a window that may not stay open very long. It takes a lot of work, again, to just keep moving forward at the pace to do that. Why is that important? It may be that the economy of Alaska, frankly, in 2010, might like to have some of this kind of a work activity to be getting underway. These are legitimate infrastructure, got to build them anyway, projects, and being able to meet the earlier timeline may offer some real benefits in terms of the economic impact on the citizens. And then my third point to you is simply that in the course of following the special session where AGEA passed, one of the things we did was we went around basically the pipeline country of the United States, talked to a number of large pipeline companies that we had talked to, some of them in the past, and had found that they were not necessarily interested in the in-state gas pipeline in the past. What we found now was that because of the presence of the two sponsor groups moving forward, there was a sense of momentum that something was going to be happening here in Alaska, not in the distant future. And I guess the best indication I can give to you is, again, if the open season is to occur in 2010, even though gas doesn't move in the big pipe for a number of years after that, commitments, decisions have to be made in that 2010 timeframe. And most major pipelines know that if they miss that opportunity, they have missed a very big opportunity for their future. And we saw this as a positive commitment. We believe during the session you'll probably get a chance to visit with some people that certainly are more than capable of expressing themselves and expressing their interest here. And again, we think that's good. One of the concerns I had is that the basic process here in Alaska, now that we got some things moving, not be restricted. I think the competition on the in-state side is great. When you had AGEA before you, I told you at that time that I welcomed it because it created a competition between Denali and TC Alaska. In a similar way, I think competition in-state wise would be a very healthy thing, and we're going to do everything we can to help that happen.
Fantastic. Thank you, Harold. That was my question, the same question that I had asked Bill Walker, is whether or not you saw a potential for an NSTAR line or a company similarly situated line as mutually exclusive to the plans that you've laid out. Because your project and the Port Authorities are heavily dependent on the open season in 2010 and the AGEA process, but different and distinct from the proposed bullet line. And so I'm glad to hear those comments. If you have anything further you'd like to
Well, let me see if I can answer your question more fully, Senator, because I think it's very important to realize. Certainly, I see NSTAR as an example, for instance, of both competitive concepts, competitive project. And all I can tell you is I think that's good. I would be worried if we thought we could pick the right answer right now. I think if nothing else, you should look at the reversal of the world in 6 months and say, well, maybe this isn't so easy to divine exactly what the right set of circumstances are and what the right solution is. I would argue that if we could even continue to expand the players, the projects, the concepts, the opportunities, I think that's good. And again, I would urge you to let the market speak. And the market speaks through the commitment of gas, the financing, the funding, all those types of steps. And I think that's a crucial piece of this puzzle right now if we're going to get the best deal for Alaskans.
Thank you. Senator Wilikowski.
Question on that point, though. If we're letting the market speak, how do you envision the public partnership? And you expressed some concern about just doing this, having private industry do this by themselves. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Senator, through the chair, I wish I had all the answers there. This is an area to be worked on very seriously. I think in a very preliminary sort of way, The indications we have are that it's quite easy to visualize and frankly evaluate what a full, just sort of private investor approach looks like. I think it's very easy to visualize and evaluate what a fully public approach looks like. It's all debt. The trick is that in many cases, again, many examples all over the United States, the idea of public-private partnership and achieving some of the good from both sides, and it doesn't require give, okay? I assure you an investor doesn't make as much in a public-private partnership as they would if it was all theirs. But on the other hand, I would not support the public taking all the risk, and nor do I think the public has all the expertise to conduct a project like this. So I think the middle ground there is a fertile one. Where that middle ground is right now, I don't know. I think that, again, one goes and hires the consultants, you ask the right questions, and then all of us kind of listen to the answers. And there is a risk reward here that we need to understand. And I think that can be part of the process over the next year, not of making a decision, but of understanding at least form and structure and those kind of questions, because that's ultimately what affects the utility bills all of us pay.
Yeah, and I know we're pressed for time, but just, and I kind of thought we had that. I thought the governor had a press conference. She said ANGDA would be working with NSTAR. Where are we with that situation?
After that press conference, we did have some conversations. There's been some attempts to do some things. As I would understand it from the press, NSTAR's main conversations has been with the administration, and you know, you're certainly welcome to ask them later on following me. To my knowledge, we have not progressed in this area. I will tell you we have talked to other companies, and I believe there is some opportunity to progress with them.
Senator Stevens.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, some of our population, of course, is off the grid, and I always appreciate your comments on propane, Harold. But are there any successful examples we can look to out there that have something like we have with a small population communities, a small population or medium population, where we can actually move propane in, by barge or ship? Does anything exist, the technology exists for that?
Senator, through the chair, I just remind you, our small communities kind of look like some of those small farm communities and kind of the more rural farm setting of almost the entire Midwest. And if you look around at who are the big propane companies and where they are and what they do, they operate in areas where there's a long distance between the consumers. Each consumer is a spot, and there may be miles between the spots in terms of their service. Clearly in Alaska, we see a certain amount of it in terms of tankage. Even in this community here, I remember living in Juneau for a period of time and having a big propane tank outside the house. In this case around here, it's a source of where does it come from? It comes from Canada and from Bellingham and other places like that. There would be an opportunity for some different source here. We also are looking at some other ideas. One of the clearest of which is the concept of a tank that's the same size as an ISO container. And if you could imagine the common 20-foot, 40-foot you find all over Alaska, we managed to get them everywhere. Well without roads, and you imagine a tank inside that steel frame of that size and shape, that could be used just as you take the propane bottle down to the hardware store, turn it in, pick up the full one, and go out. And if you think about making those containers here in Alaska, and a lot of other things like that with maybe low interest loans to pay for them by communities, all of a sudden, some of the storage issues start to get solved pretty quick, and the transportation issues. And again, the great part of what we're trying to do is get it to the point where it tips to the entrepreneurs. And I honestly believe the entrepreneurs of Alaska are more than capable of figuring out some great ways to do all this stuff. So we want to turn them loose.
Great. Thank you very much. We look forward to hearing more about propane. Oh, Senator Huggins, my
excuse me, just two quick questions. Harold, you mentioned the AGIA process and progressing, and why wouldn't we tailor in-state gas to an AGIA process?
as far as, Senator, I'm sorry.
Yeah, just as a process. Why wouldn't we take in-state gas and just boilerplate it down to an NGA process? And why wouldn't we do that?
Senator, through the chair, I, as I've indicated to you in the past, and I think I'm being entirely consistent with everything I've ever told you, I saw the AGEA process virtue as it was creating competition. And I believe that you can create competition in this case without going through that process, because I would suggest that the flaw that I saw in the AGEA process was that it tried to pick a winner. And again, I believe the market picks winners. And I think we're going to ultimately end up with that in the big line, too. But we'll just have to see.
Senator Huggins.
Right. And on your bullets, multiple of them, but as an example, announced a gas supply co-op. What sort of guidance do you have for the administration on things that you're pursuing?
The ANGDA board under the statute is empowered to do certain things, and the broad mission is to do whatever it takes to help get North Slope gas to market and to do it in such a way that it benefits Alaskans. We do have a liaison with the administration through Marsha Davis, who's a deputy commissioner of the Department of Revenue. I am a state employee. The people who do our contracting are state employees. You'll find our contracts are signed off within the Department of Revenue, so we're obligated to follow all the state procurement things. We also, very frankly, follow very rigorously the public notice provisions of state, and frankly, we do get a pretty good public turnout at times and interest in our meetings. So in addition to the sort of being part of the state government, we also do get public feedback, I think, fairly aggressively. We also have outreached, and we do try to at least create some level of dialogue all along the route, you might say, and interface with people. We've sought ideas and participate pretty fully in conferences, other things, whenever we get a chance.
Guidance. The question is guidance from the administration.
In terms of guidance, I thought I received some of that in July, about the 8th of July, as I remember. The governor issued a press conference. We were there with us. She told us to take care of Fairbanks if we could, develop whatever idea.
Subsequent to July.
Okay. But it's important that both the propane timeline and B2F, the majority of that chart, is a result of the stimulus given to us in that guidance. And since then, we've moved forward. Again, if you follow us closely, you'll see that our meetings and our direction and decisions are pretty well publicized in the petroleum news. Occasionally, the other media chooses to cover us, whether it be talk radio or the Anchorage Daily News. We even show up in the Valley occasionally on some of the media out there.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Harold. We appreciate it. We'll take a very brief at ease to allow the star to come forward. Five. And we have the last part of our overview today. We have Colleen Starring with NSTAR and Mr. George Schreibner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to thank the committee for the invitation to provide an update on NSTAR's progress and plans going forward for the in-state gas needs. Mr. Schreiber is the president and CEO of Continental Energy Systems, who is the holding company, parent company of NSTAR, and he's going to go forward with the presentation this afternoon.
Thank you. Likewise, I thank you for your time and for the update. This is basically going to be to update you all for the presentation that Colleen was here about a year ago. I think it was March of last year. What we want to cover basically is the current situation, what the impact on customers are going to be, our proposal on a course of action which we think solves the in-state gas issue, what future supply and demand will be, and then we have some conclusions. I'm going to speak a little quickly, kind of like the guy on the Federal Express commercial a few years ago, because I know time is short and I want to make sure we leave time for questions. Basically, I'm sure you've seen this chart before. It shows what's happening in the Cook Inlet in terms of availability and deliverability of gas and the reserves there. Obviously, we have a serious issue when you get out to the middle of the next decade. And that's really what we're aiming at, because we feel that if we are not having gas, in-state gas, flowing to our customers by 2014, 2015. We're not going to be able to hook up new customers, and we're going to be forcing existing customers to switch off of gas to other sources of energy to heat their homes. This chart, which I know a lot of you have seen before, basically is confirmed with what has happened to us here recently. And this is a chart. We're not trying to see how many numbers we can put on one page. And I apologize for that. But there's a lot of information here. And what we have done is we have taken the contract we negotiated about 2.5 years ago, APL 5, extrapolated out to where we are, which is the last two contracts on the right side of the page. What I want to do just briefly is to highlight a couple of important facts on this page. First of all, when you look down towards the bottom of the page where it says term of the agreement, the APL 5 agreement went out to 2016. So we had negotiated and contracted for gas to 2016, which marries very nicely with our proposal on the NSTAR line, which would be delivering gas in 2015. That was an all requirements contract. So the supplier in that contract, as we needed gas and as the market grew, they were contracting to supply all that gas. What I would like to point out to you as you read across, though, is where we finally ended up, because the RCA rejected APL 5, were contracts that ran for 2 years, okay, and not for, I guess, 9 years when we were negotiating this. And most importantly, look what happens to the volumes. And this is where I say it kind of confirms the previous chart. Volumes in the APL 5 contract was 60 BCF. We're looking at 10 BCF under the current contracts. If you also, I will tell you that those two new contracts are not all requirements contracts. The other area I would highlight for you is the pricing that happened. We spent basically 2.5, 3 years and spent over $2 million with consultants, lawyers negotiating these contracts, and the prices are virtually the same. I would submit to you that the RCA did our customers a huge disservice by turning down the APL 5 contract. I also think that shows what the state of the situation is in the Cook Inlet. With all due respect to what Harold and Bill have said, we can't wait for the big line to come on, because our customers are going to suffer, and as I said, we'll talk about the impact on customers in just a minute. What we have here in the next slide, and I'm not going to go over this, it's really the takeaways, which I just highlighted from the page with all the numbers. If you look at what's happened to our customers as we go forward here, just want to point out a couple of things. 96 cents that we get of each of our customers' dollars basically go to the cost of delivering gas. There's only 4 cents in every dollar that comes to NSTAR. I would also point out to you, and this is a little bit counterintuitive, and that is that higher prices really hurt our business, because the way we make money, our profitability is tied to the part of our rate to customers, which is tied to volume. So in other words, with low prices, customers use a lot more gas, we'll make more money. High prices, customers conserve, less gas flows through the line, and since our profitability is tied to a volumetric charge, we make less money when the price of gas goes up. So it's counterintuitive. I know some people have trouble understanding it, but it's a fact. And one of the things that we're going to try and do in the long term, we've tried to do it in Michigan, we'll also introduce it here in our next rate case, is to try and insulate ourselves from those volumetric fluctuations so that we can promote conservation and try and help our customers more. But that's the subject of another hearing. On the residential cost for gas, Alaska still enjoys the lowest cost gas in the nation, and we've laid that out in slide on page 9. Now, what I'm talking about in terms of what happens if we don't have gas in 2014, 2015, this is the impact on customers. We think it's dramatic, and we think it has a huge impact on the economy in the state, and we think that it's going to obviously have a huge impact on our customers. What we have done here is we have tried to show what the average bill is for the average consumption on our system, and we've converted that to the current price of oil, propane, and electricity. So that natural gas, obviously by this page, is the cheapest source. And as I said, we get out to 2015, we will not be able to hook up new customers, and we'll be starting to tell existing customers, you've got to switch your source of energy. Also, I'd like to point out, these numbers do not include the cost of a new furnace, a new hot water heater. okay? So that would also have to be borne by the customers. But as you can see, customers who are paying $150 a month now for gas are looking at, if they go to oil, $218 a month. If they go to electricity, it's over $500 a month. What we have proposed, I think, changes the market for natural gas in Alaska. And what we're proposing is that we were able to move newly discovered gas to the interior and to South Central. We're doing this because we think that it is the right thing for Alaska, for our customers, and for our business, quite frankly. What we are going to require is a governmental framework that promotes private sector investment in this process, and that we have predictable and fair market prices for natural gas as we go forward. I'm sure you all are familiar with this chart. It doesn't show up well here. Hopefully you have a chart in front of you. It shows you that we're initially starting out taking gas from the foothills around the Gubik area and bringing it to South Central with the 33-mile line that will come off of that line to serve Fairbanks. It's a 690-mile pipeline. It is a 20-inch diameter. It'll flow 500 MCF a day. It is going to be a project that we estimate to cost about $4 billion at this point. We are still working through those numbers, but it lays out that over this five-year period, we would have about, at current estimates, $4 billion invested. The next slide lays out where we are. As I think Colleen told you last year, we are going to invest $5 million looking at engineering, environmental studies, construction studies, aerial photographs, LIDAR review, the whole thing to look at siting right away and engineering. Those studies are about complete. We'll probably have them complete by the end of February, first part of March. The whole $5 million will be spent. 2009 calls for field work to begin and the other items that we have in the box here on the left, where we would call to spend another $14 million. 2010, we would be spending another $53 million. This is all on the permitting, the engineering, the site, and that kind of thing. When you get out to 2011, that's when the big bucks start to be spent. And it's from 2011 to 2014 is where you get up to the $3 billion number. We thought it would be helpful to show you what we've been doing and where some of this, our $5 million has gone. We have retained a world-class team of consultants to help us with this process, and they are the ones that are helping us doing the engineering review, doing the siting, doing the right-of-way work, and starting to look at the process surrounding getting the permits so we can get this pipeline flowing gas by 2015. Importantly, there are obviously, in a project of the size, a lot of things that come together. We obviously need supply on the north end, because we're going to be flowing gas from north to south. There is not gas in the Cook Inlet that's going to be able to be taken anywhere. Okay, and we also need customers, and so what we've tried to do here on slide 19 is to indicate. There are several areas along the way where we hope to be able to pick up additional gas. Under the theory, if you build it, they will come. We think we're going to be able to start out with gas from one of these various areas that are highlighted on the screen. We have had preliminary conversations with Anadarko, and as you all, I know, I'm sure, are aware, they had one rig up in the Gubik area last year. They have two rigs this season. We would expect to get another report for them probably in the spring, late spring, on what is there. I think the fact that they've increased from one rig to two rig up there gives you an indication that they do think there's some supply there, and we're working on that basis. While we don't have anything definitive, we think that there probably is gas there and sufficient amount of gas to move south, to hook up into Fairbanks, and to get into South Central. In terms of the customers for our gas, you know, there are many of the names that you all are very familiar with. What I will tell you is that first we need supply, but most importantly, and the thing I worry the most about, are having the customers to take the gas. Okay, we need a fully operating Agrium plant. We need a fully operating at capacity LNG export facility. We need Fairbanks built out. It's very interesting that with Fairbanks completely gasified, and I'm talking about running mains down residential neighborhoods and getting gas to homes, Fairbanks, with its population, will have about the same demand for gas that Anchorage has. It's a huge market because of the weather. It's a really nice market, quite frankly. If we can get that gas in there, it'd be a great business. We also need to, and we've heard about other opportunities that may be available. Again, under the category, if you build it, they will come. Talk of the petrochemical plant that you just heard about. We've heard about a limestone operation that needs a heat source that could be very attractive and take gas off our line. We think that there are other opportunities that will be created. The whole driving force here is to get a significant customer base, because the more gas we put through the line, the lower the tariff's going to be, and all of our customers will benefit from that. So we not only are concerned about what we're going to find out about supply, as I said, our main focus and my biggest concern is generating enough of a customer base, because the more we can put through the line, the lower that tariff's going to be. In terms of conclusions, what we'd like you to take away from our appearance today is the fact that the need for additional gas, we think, is starting to get to a critical point. And it's going to have a significant impact on the market if we're not successful getting our line in place. We have contracted all of our requirements only through 2010, not through 2016. Natural gas consumption obviously is important. When you see what happens to customers when you have to go to alternative sources of gas, it's obviously significant. Fair market prices are an important part of this whole ingredient, because it will be an important factor in securing future gas supplies, and it will also help the fact that producers are out investing a lot of money trying to find gas to serve our customers' needs. The cost of switching, as we mentioned earlier on, is going to be very detrimental to customers. Government-mandated discounts are not going to remedy the supply deliverability problems. We found over the last 2 years that has not had much appeal to the folks that have the product. We think what we need is a government to set a sound public policy that allows for the private sector to invest capital to develop this business and get gas to our customers, and develop storage, because that will also be a part of this whole process. And the final thing that we really need to stress is that time is of the essence. We've got to get this line built and flowing gas by the 2014-2015 timeframe.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm confused. Just, I thought a few months ago there was a press conference and NSTAR was going north out of Cook Inlet. So has there been a change, or did I just...
I wouldn't say there's been a change. We participated, obviously, with ANGDA in the press conference. There was discussion on providing relief to Fairbanks in as quick amount of time as possible. But we had gas contracts pending before the RCA at that time that gave us an additional 5 years of supply. We also had one of our current suppliers who we have options to purchase additional gas. Since that time, the RCA did not approve those contracts as submitted. They required amendments. We were not able to negotiate those amendments with the producers. And so what we've come to realize is, as Mr. Schreiber showed you in the earlier slide, we went from 60 BCF of gas and what we think is a lot of exploration going on to 10 BCF of gas. One of our current suppliers has declined an option for gas that we had under contract out in 2013. And so it just has become clear to us that, you know, if there's gas in the inlet, nobody's got it, you know, offering it to us under contract. Nobody's exploring. We know that there's been exploration in the inlet. However, those efforts have not been successful. I mean, it's geology, it's science. I think the producers, based on what we know or can see, are drilling and exploring. They just haven't had the successes that they did back in the 60s and 70s, and the big finds have not proved up.
Yeah, basically, Senator, they are, listen, these are commercial guys, okay, and they want to monetize their assets. We are finding it more and more difficult to get them to contract for gas. And so the, our thinking has changed dramatically. We're going to have to get gas from the north and bring it south because the gas on the inlet is just not there.
And Madam Chairman, if I could, on page 16 and under 2009, talk about the field work in a legislative package. You want to elaborate on what the legislative package for 09 is?
Well, we're in the conceptual stage of trying to figure out if we need some legislation to help expedite permitting, expedite right-of-way review, make sure that there is a process that fair market prices can be determined in a timely fashion. And, you know, we're considering whether that might make some sense to propose some legislation for you all to consider to help in the process so we can make our timeline of 2015.
In addition, we've looked at issues such as contract versus common carrier. We've, you know, been very cognizant of the AGEA process and trying to match as much as what we'd like to do to that process. And so at this point, we're just looking at a lot of things that could come into play.
You know, one thing I forgot to mention as I raced through the presentation, and that is, notwithstanding today's capital markets, we have the financing for this project basically in place. The folks that own Continental and NSTAR just raised another fund of $5 billion. They basically have $1 billion to commit to this investment. This is the kind of investment which they've been looking for, and they are very excited about this opportunity. So we basically have the funding in place.
So you're not going to come to the legislature and want $500 million or some other number?
You want to give it to us, we'll take it, but we're not going to come and ask for it.
Okay. You're not looking for a partner?
No, we are not.
Okay. Senator Wilikowski and then Senator French.
Yeah, thank you. I know we're short on time, so I have a lot of questions and concerns about some of the things you have in your report, some of the things you've said. One of the things I really disagree with is your assessment of the RCA decision. I thought that was a good decision. I thought that was the right decision for the consumers of South Central, who just a few years who've seen their prices triple in the last few years from what they're paying, and in many conversations that I've had with people that deal with production and Cook Inlet have told me that the costs for the wells, the capitalization costs, are 50 cents to a dollar per MCF. And so I know there's more costs for the newer wells, but we're still working under a lot of the existing wells. And I know there's still continued production, but I know it hasn't increased that dramatically. And so I think the consumers in South Central would greatly disagree with your assessment that the RCA did a disservice. I do.
And let me just comment on that. The historical cost of the wells that are producing gas today goes back 40 years, okay? We know one of our suppliers has spent in the order of $100 million trying to find new reserves in the Cook Inlet and have been basically unsuccessful. So the market price that we're asking our customers to pay for the commodity supports continued exploration and development. Okay, to date it has been unsuccessful, and the other problem with the RCA rejecting that order, they've put a tremendous amount of risk on our customers to be able to make sure that we have supplies of gas for them in a market of declining reserves, because that contract was an all requirements contract. Our supplier was on the hook to supply whatever gas we needed, and now we don't have that.
Well, and ConocoPhillips sat right where you were sitting just a couple months ago and testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee that they had a 20-year supply in Cook Inlet. They had 1.7 in proven reserves, TCF. So ConocoPhillips and DOE would not have approved their export license if there wasn't enough gas for South Central. Conoco verified that when they submitted their application to DOE. So we're hearing a different thing from the producers. We're hearing that there's plenty of gas in Cook Inlet. The average basin reserve is about 8 years. We've got more than double that in Cook Inlet. So what we're hearing from other people is there's more than enough gas in Cook Inlet.
But I'm sure what they've also told you, that if the LNG plant doesn't operate, the gas will not be there. Because wells fill up with water, the gas becomes undeliverable, so you can't have one without the other. Now, I don't know what what ConocoPhillips testified to, and I would not presume to represent them. All I'm saying is that we think it's fair that consumers pay a market price for gas. That will then incentivize the producers to find more gas, like Anadarko's doing up north, and the consumer will benefit. Because otherwise, the consumer's going to go to that chart that shows if they have to heat their home with oil or electricity.
Just one question then. What is your projected cost per MCF if once this line comes online?
Well, is
it going to be the same as what it is?
You know, if we used what we have used in the past, okay, whether it's with Unocal or whether it's with Marathon or Conoco, if you used a Henry Hub price, okay, that is a proxy for the market price. Okay, and the reason Henry Hub is used, because the guys that do that for a living are then able to hedge the cost of gas, and they can do things in their business off of a price which the market recognizes as a proxy for the market price. So I would say to you, I don't know what it's going to be in terms of dollars, but if you follow Henry Hub over a period of time, that will be approximately what our customers would pay for the price of gas.
Including transportation costs?
Including transportation
costs. So it would be a flat Henry. So Henry Hub's at $4.80.
Right. So if we had a one-year Henry Hub rolling average, then if we were sitting in October and recalculating our contracts based on a one-year Henry Hub price, and the price happens to be $4.80, and it was $4.80 throughout the year, our customers would be paying $4.80 as opposed to the $8.97.
And I guess what would prevent you from doing the same? I mean, would that be an acceptable index for you in Cook Inlet?
Most certainly. In fact, APL, Chevron, our contract with Unocal Chevron that was approved in 2003 was tied to Henry Hub. And when we negotiated the subsequent contract, since that had been an approved contract through the RCA, that's what was the negotiated index that was turned down. So yes, Henry Hub, I mean, the markets work. At some point during the hearings, it was at $9 and $10. Subsequently, it's down to $4 or $5. I mean, we believe we'll have a very good story to tell customers next January 1st. But again, you can't predict the markets. They go up and down. In this case, it's working in their favor.
If you recall, Senator Wilikowski, that was the contract that was rejected, and it was rejected based on a viewpoint that Henry Hub prices may not be indicative of the marketplace of Alaska. And they used the Japanese LNG contract as an example for that.
And I guess my point, just in closing, if you can make money at $4.80 and Alaskan consumers are now paying $10.57, that's a pretty big gap.
But we're not making money on the commodity. We make no money on the commodity. It is a straight price pass through. Okay, that is an issue for the consumers. When we sign up to buy gas, we don't make any. We make no money on it. It is all passed through to the consumer.
Senator French.
My questions have been answered. Thank you.
Okay. Further questions, Senator Huggins?
Yeah, just very quickly. Could you give us about a 10-second burst on with the coal streak in and about Anchorage and Mat-Su Valley, what sort of actions you had to take to make sure that pilot light stayed on?
I don't say anything in a short amount of time.
Right.
Well, the recent cold snap was a challenge. What we like to say is if we left management out of the equation and let the field operators all work together, we'd be fine. But during the cold snap, we had all three of our suppliers backfilling each other as they had problems with deliverability and their wells. We also had, to the best of our knowledge and what our system measurement has showed, the LNG plant fully diverted. They had 10,000, I believe, left at the plant. The plant was fully diverted into the system to keep everybody up and running. The cold snap that we experienced had an average over the 11 days of negative 12 degrees. We've gone back and done some analysis, and if we were to have a sustained cold snap with 15 or 20 degrees below zero, we would lose considerable parts of our system.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Stedman.
Just got a quick one. On your slide, page 20, talks about some of your potential anchor tenants, and I understand the concept there of the $4 billion investment, and you're going to want some anchor tenants to make sure this is successful. But can you elaborate a little bit? You said you need an export facility. So what in your view, how critical is the export facility, and what is the export facility you're talking about in the volumes? Is it new ones, old ones, or?
When we go through the analysis, the economic analysis, what we have considered is the current LNG plant at Kenai, fully operating and exporting at capacity, as well as Agrium. One or the other would suffice, or a new LNG export facility. The in-state gas requirements, we've determined it's about 250 million cubic feet. LNG or Agrium would take up the other 250, which would make this a very affordable tariff for our customers.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Or Madam Chair.
Any further questions from the committee? Okay. With that, thank you very much to both of you for appearing before us today, and we look forward to your continued work and talking to you in the future.
Thank you.
With that, we're adjourned.